Hi, this is a Football Fans Podcast and people behind CelticUnderground.net. Spoiler alert, there's a doctor on here. Spoiler alert, we talk about the coronavirus. Decent spoiler alert. If you've been getting uptight recently, this will be a good podcast to listen to. Okay, so people often say that doing a podcast is not brain surgery, but I'm going to prove that's not the point, as I'm joined by brain surgeon Pablo Fire. And I'm not joking, he is a brain surgeon. How are you doing?
I'm very well, Harry. How are you?
I'm excellent. So we first had a conversation about doing the podcast when the reports came out about heading the football. And yep, with you being yep. a brain surgeon, getting back to my point of you really are a brain surgeon, with you being a brain surgeon, that would have been a very relevant topic of conversation. But we have more pressing medical issues, so we'll maybe come back to revisit the issue with heading the football and dementia later. But before we can get started on anything, I first need to set up your credentials to be on the Celtic Underground podcast. So, what was your first Celtic game, or what was your first earliest Celtic memories, probably better, and who was your first Celtic hero?
First Celtic memory. My first Celtic game was 1985 Cup Final. My dad's uncle was Neely Mokin.
Right.
And he would have got his tickets for that, and I remember that very clearly. In fact, my clearest... Well, I can certainly remember going standing on the terrace in the north stand of Hampden that day and not being able to see very much. But my abiding memory of it was I remember the Heel Man's umbrella very well. And that thing that you did when you were a kid in those days, had been stood outside a pub when I was probably 6 years old. Being stood outside a pub under the Heel Man's umbrella, the usual sort of can of coke in the back. Kids to keep you company, sort of thing. So, yeah.
And who's your first Celtic hero?
Given the age I am, it would have been. It was Brian McClair.
Right.
He was absolutely fantastic, and I remember being absolutely heartbroken when he left us. given my age, that was just the sort of the starter course to the. Unnecessariness that then went and became he who shall not be named.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know, that was one of the things at the time, I liked Brian McClair and always felt he was more of a footballer, he was more of a modern day striker than Johnson, but I always felt people were more enamoured with Mojo because he was much more of a penalty box striker putting the ball in the back of the net. So I always feel a bit vindicated that I was much more of a Brian McClair man than a Mojo man. So anyway, we're on and we're going to talk medical. And again, don't worry, we are not going to always remember the audience with Billy Connolly when he talks about the way the telly used to shut down and would frighten all the old people, you know, remember to stick the elastic band in the Doberman Pinscher's willy and stuff like that. So we're not going to be putting the willies up you. Talking about the coronavirus, but we are going to talk about the consequences of the virus on Scottish football, since that's what we're all interested in. So, give some insight into why the football had to be stopped in the first place, Pablo.
So, well, essentially what we have is we have a virus which has, the likes of which has really been seen before in terms of affecting humans. It is quite nasty. It is very contagious in terms of it spreads through people. It's not in the same level as it spreads as quick as measles, but it spreads fairly effectively.
Well, you can tell me, actually. I mean, I'm not... I mean, obviously, I stopped listening to too much news in the last few days because it's too unsettling. But before it became big, I listened to something about a month ago. It shows you the benefit of a vaccine. Does the measles infects, for every one person who gets it, if we didn't have the vaccine, it'd be 18 people. It would pass on to us something terrible like that. It's horrendous.
I don't know if it's that high. The number I had in mind for that was 10. Although I'm open to be corrected. But yeah, measles is extremely, extremely contagious. But measles is bloody horrible. The difference between measles and coronavirus is basically that essentially people get measles and get it really badly are actually young people that get it, and it causes really lasting side effects. So thankfully we're not there with coronavirus. The problem with coronavirus is basically nothing like it's ever been seen before, so nobody's remotely immune to it. So it's going to sweep through. And there's not a lot you can really do about it apart from try not to get it and try not to pass it on. And so it's having to go sort of really slowly. Or we're trying to have to do it as slowly as we can, I guess. So we're kind of here that there's this disease that's sort of going to go through us. For the most part, most of us are only going to have a mild illness from it, but unfortunately it's going to affect a lot of older or more vulnerable people in a way that is potentially going to overwhelm the healthcare system. So we've got to try and slow it down as best we can so that those serious cases go through the healthcare system in as slow a way as can be manageable. The reason why football's had to slow down, it's because obviously footballers are as paranoid as the rest of us about A, getting something like this, and B, passing it on to elderly relatives that might become unwell as a result of it. And I suppose thirdly, they want to be nice, sociable people and want to make sure it's that they do their bit to slow it down as best the rest of us can. Actually, the other main reason why football slowed down is because if the healthcare system is so geared up that it's in emergency mode, that all it can do is look after people who are sick as a result of this and look after the other people who get really serious things. What the healthcare system can't do is devote resources to supporting things like football. So things like your ambulances at football games, your ambulances to support crowds, your ambulances to support, you know, big crowd movements, violence as a result of these things and fights and pubs and what have you, can't happen. So that's why all this is shut down.
So, in terms of that, I mean, one of the things that one of my mates was going on about was he couldn't understand why we couldn't have just carried on. I mean, obviously things have moved dramatically and rapidly in the last 10 days. So when he said this, it was a wee bit different. But his question was, why couldn't we have just proceeded behind closed doors?
Well, the simple truth to that is that you can't play football at a high level without a paramedic ambulance. And I tweeted this morning a story that I found from the Sun last year where they were essentially ridiculing the fact that at a training session at the Celtic training complex ahead of the FC Sarajevo game last year, Celtic had to have a Scottish Ambulance Service paramedic ambulance in attendance at our training session. And that was a result of UEFA's health and safety regulations at a training session ahead of one of their games. And that's a training session. That's not even an actual match. So you can't divert resources which are needed to deal with a pandemic, which is as severe as it is right now, to support football in this instance. So quite simply, from a health and safety point of view of the footballers, it's totally unreasonable. If a footballer has a serious injury and there's no paramedic there, then unfortunately, and anybody organising football is leaving themselves without a leg to stand on.
Okay, so that's why we couldn't play it behind closed doors. So the next thing that, Boris Johnson tonight has said, we might get through the worst of this in the next 12 weeks. Now, I do find it interesting that people talk in weeks, because I always think talking to people about things in weeks sounds less than talking to people in months, if you know what I mean. So if you, I always think 12 weeks sounds less than 3 months. So I do find it interesting that using that terminology. But 12 weeks, roughly, is end of April, end of May, end of June.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, layman here, we're not completing the football season we're not start. We'll put it this way: if we're through, if we're going to be through the worst of it, end of June, mm-hmm. we're not going to start playing football on the 1st of July, are we?
No, quite simply not. I mean, if you're saying we're through the worst of it, then I mean, when Celtic's first game last season?
Oh, just there or thereabouts, about the 10th of July, something like that, was it? 7th of July, something like that?
Okay, and so that was, although that was the first round of Champions League qualifying, there is actually a round before that.
Yeah.
The preliminary round, and that's two-legged as well. And so you're in a position there where if you say, right, well, this season is going to start, and inevitably the European qualifying games are the start of a season, everybody's got to be able to start then. You can't have a bit of this or a bit of that. It's very hard to know how that's all going to work out. UEFA's thing about saying this is the, you know, the 30th of June is the cut-off date, I think is very interesting. And how that is interpreted going forward, I think, is going to be the key to a lot of things. I've very little idea why you had the English Premiership. The English Premiership, I think, yesterday, and then the Scottish Leagues again there today, come out and use April the 30th as some sort of cut off, as if, oh yeah, everything will be fine, and yeah, we'll make a decision, and then I'm sure we'll get going just after that.
I did wonder whether there's a whole load of conspiracy theories just now, and the worst thing you can do is talk to people who want to pronounce on expanding their thoughts on getting 1% of information and expanding it. I did wonder, though, whether as part of the let's not make it feel too bad to people, whether they're just unilaterally picking that date, or whether in conjunction with the government, the government have said to them, look, don't set dates too far in the future. Make it seem to people as we've only got, people can put the effort in. If you can say to them, you've only got to do this for a month, people put the effort in. And then in a month's time, you can say, look, we just need a wee bit more effort, and you can push them out for another month. So I did wonder, in the sort of paranoid world, if there's as much a part of the government asking them to not say, well, bugger this, we're not going to be making a decision until September, you know?
I think the opposite. I think the government and the football authorities are both looking at each other and looking for the other one to blink. I think there are actually advantages to football to a certain extent if the government comes out and says you're not playing football until a certain point, which, you know, and then they can move on. What you have at the moment, I think, is everybody's just kicking the can down the road. It's the same as what the government are doing to the licence trade and various other people, that they're actually saying, well, do you know what? See, if you're a responsible and good person, you won't go to the pub. Fine. Okay. The pubs, if the government says, close all pubs, the pubs then can trigger insurance, they can hold the government responsible for that decision. But right now, nobody's actually telling them to close their doors. What they're doing is they're telling the people not to go to them. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think what you've got is you've got, between UEFA, the football associations, the governments, you've basically got a bunch of people following each other around in a circle and hoping the guy in front of them trips so they can blame him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just let's be realistic from the information we know. So the government's talking about we'll be through the worst of this in 12 weeks' time. Now, you're the medical expert, not me. You've already made the point. So my understanding is this. Once you've got it, you're immune to it. Like most viruses, once you've had it, your body then gets an immunity to it, or lots of viruses. Yep. So once you've got it, you're through it. The flattening the curve that you talked about is we don't have a vaccine at the moment. So we're all going to get it until the vaccine's here. So we need to spread out that burden on the health service of us getting it. So the whole strategy at the moment is we're about to hit. And I saw an interesting graph about the Spanish flu 100 years ago that there was two major spikes when they had it. And so that's the other thing that's concerned the government is spike number two. So we're going through spike number one at the moment. How big that will be determined when it is. But the government thinks spike number one is going to be in the next 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. So based on all of that, we're not playing football until the end of June. Absolute minimum.
Oh, categorically. I mean, but even then, it's at what point the players are happy to play. You know, you're going to have some sort of agreement with the players' unions for them to say, right, we are happy to resume competitive football on date X. That is also then going to be contingent on them being happy to have a pre-season, which we're going to have, mm-hmm. which will that include friendlies, or are people just going to go straight into competitive football?
Who knows? I mean, it may well be that the Football Authority's attitudes are, say, for instance, they decide to finish the season. It may well be that they take the attitude of, we're going to use finishing the season as the equivalent of your pre-season because we just don't have the time to do anything else.
I can't see
the elite clubs agreeing to that. I'm just saying that that's maybe the way they'll look at it.
I don't see any clubs agreeing to that. And I'll tell you why. I think the main problem that football clubs are going to have now, maybe not at the top end in England, but I think for the most part, the clubs that are dependent on game day revenue, which is basically Scotland and quite a lot of the rest of European football, it suits a lot of clubs to say 1920 is done and it's over and it's tough to move on. And the player contracts that are going to come to an end at what should be the end of the season, they're done as well. So El Yunusi, Forster, Calvin Miller, Craig Gordon, all these, Johnny Hayes, out of contract, that's all done, that's all gone. And then we move on to another season, and then we just move on to them when that season is going to start. But that's what we then start doing, as we say, 30th of June. At that point, that is when your domestic associations are going to have to nominate who they need to go into European competitions next season, and we all just have to move on. And that has one big advantage, that any football played after that date will then be in another season. And any football played after that date, you won't have spectators turning up with season tickets in their hands from the previous season expecting to get in front.
Yeah.
That is massively advantageous. And also, if you draw that line in the sand, then the money from your sponsors, your money from your prize money, your money from your broadcasters all comes in and you know where you are. And that's why I just can't see this indefinite thing of where, yeah, okay, we'll finish 1920 when we get to it. I just don't see that happening.
Well, I don't either. From the very simple thing is what we've just discussed. So say, for instance, the UK does, if we're all at different timetables, say Spain and Italy think that they're through the worst of this June time. But because and say those two countries have it the worst in Europe, say we never reach their spikes, which would be a hope that we can have. Say we never reach their spikes, they're naturally going to be much more conservative coming out of a lockdown, because they'll be needing time to recover from what they've just been through.
Yes.
So one of the other difficult things is Europe's going to be coming out of this at different times as well.
Yeah, but also you're going to have for the economies to rebound and for society to rebound, one of the things you're going to have to do is reopen the borders.
Yeah.
And this is going to have to be an international recovery. It's not going to be the case where, you know, there's rumours that the Chinese League is going to start again the 20th of April, which is just nonsense. That might be where they've kicked the can down the road to. I mean, we've kicked the can down the road to the 30th of April, which very conveniently is payday in April, by the way. Mm-hmm. You're going to have some sort of global coordinated...
Well,
right. This is what we're going to do. And my theory on this very much is, I think this is my slightly Machiavellian way of looking at it. If you look at the global sporting calendar, where UEFA takes its lead from, where everybody takes the lead from, is actually the Olympics. Every single sporting event in the world works around the Olympics. And everybody is looking at the Olympics and saying, come on, guys, just move a year. And then we can reorganise every single sporting event in the year. We'll just add 1 year onto it and then we're fine. Okay? UEFA have sort of taken the lead on that already in football by moving Euro 2020 to 2021. And in doing so, they can then rewrite the global football in, or not the global football calendar, the European football calendar. Okay? And what it's going to take is all the leagues are going to have to be finished by a certain point, because your European competitions are all going to have to start at a certain point. So you can't have this people finishing leagues at different points, because you're going to have the teams nominated to go into European competition. So it has to come from the top and sort of filter down. So European football will have to be governed by UEFA's timescale. And that's why that cut-off of the 30th of June is actually very important. UEFA aren't going to tell domestic leagues, this is how you settle this. They're just going to say, by the 30th of June, we want a name and a bit of paper which says, here are our people and here are the slots they're going into. Because they need to move on with European competition. Now, the possible exceptions to that are domestic cup competitions. As well as the European cup competitions from last season, who knows how they're going to finish. But something like the Scottish Cup, I can see there being a fantastic argument that if you resume Scottish football late July, August, you resume it and you do it in a blaze of glory with your Scottish Cup semi-finals and final, and there we go, we're back with a bang. I can see that being a brilliant thing to do.
You could have the semi-finals on a Wednesday night and the final on the Saturday. I mean, you could do it Saturday to Saturday, but the point I'm making is it doesn't have to be dragged out.
Aye, exactly, and it doesn't have consequences for the payout of sponsorships, prize money, broadcasting money particularly, or European places, because everybody would just have to agree, right, you know what, we'll put all that money in a pot and everybody can have a bit of it. And that would be a great PR thing and everybody would love it. So domestic cup competitions, I think that's exactly how you bring it all back. But in terms of this, dragging the leagues out interminably, it doesn't work. Because for next season to work, everybody has to know where we're going from a European point of view in terms of who's going into European slots, what the European football calendar is, and then we'll work backwards.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think you're right. I've thought this all along that it will be, UEFA will say, this is going to be, for me the easiest thing is, look, this is a movable feast. We are hoping for the start on this date, but bearing in mind the issues we've got with a cross-border competition, that's got to be flexible. Now, for me, the simplest thing is you ditch all international football next year. It's the only way to fit stuff into the calendar.
Well, the only international football you have to play next year is the playoffs for the... Well, not the internet. Sorry, I was going to say the Nations League playoffs. It's not. It's the Nations League qualifiers for the Euros. That's literally all the European football you have to play next... European international football you need to play next year. There are probably World Cup qualifiers next year.
World Cup qualifiers will start. They always start. They're going to have to try and find a way, I think, of curtailing them, because European club football is where the money is.
Aye.
And for me, your point is UEFA will simply say, we need to know who's playing in what competition by this date, so that we are ready to go whenever we need to go.
But that date is the 30th of June.
Yeah.
That is exactly what they're saying there, is we need the leagues finalised by that point. We're not going to tell you how to do it, but we need to know. And so if they are going to have somebody nominated to be in the champions spot for all these competitions, it says, all well and good, your president of La Liga saying, well, it's no fair, this, that, and the other. Doesn't matter. You're going to have to tell us who's in pot one and who's in pot two. And they're going to have to make the decision somehow. And I can see the logic in that from UEFA's point of view. They need to move on. Now, that's not to say that we're going to be ready to play the first qualifying round or the preliminary qualifying round of the Champions League when it needs to be played, because we probably aren't. And that's where this bit, that story that came out in the Daily Record about, okay, the SPFL and the SFA are pushing for the Scottish clubs to be automatically put into the group stages of the Champions League and Europa League, actually starts to make a bit of sense. Because if you say, right, what happens? What happens if football doesn't start until the point beyond which you don't have room for qualifiers for the Champions League? Mm-hmm. Who gets the spots? Because they're not going to hold up the Champions League. You know, Champions League match day one is arguably, you would say, that game will happen. Because that's far enough down the line that it will happen. But you might not have time for the qualifying rounds. So what happens in that event? And I think what that article was that was their way of translating the SFA, SPFL reps saying, okay, fine. If we've not got time to play the qualifiers, we'll nominate who your teams are going to be by the end of the season. That's fine. But rather than you guys take just the big money teams and you make the money, you'll need to do this in coefficient terms. You'll need to put the seeded teams through. In which case, that would be an automatic Champions League group place for Celtic, and it would be an automatic Europa League group place for the other one. Now, that is a logical outcome.
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to think, how do you, the football calendar for European competition starts at the beginning of July, because the number of clubs that are now involved in it needs all that time. But if you don't have that time, how do you get to a quicker solution? You know, one of the things I thought, which, again, the challenge is you wouldn't get the elite clubs to agree to, is, sorry, elite countries, you're not getting four Champions League qualifiers this season.
I don't think you could do that.
No, I don't think you would agree to, but just in terms of the thought process of how are we going to put, you know, all the number of games that need to take place in a truncated period of time. I mean, Scotland's already got 10 December games, so it's pretty obvious our winter break's not happening next season for a start.
Well, it depends how you look at it. But I mean, if you wanted to, one of the things they're going to have to work out is, I mean, the contingency planning is going to have to be, you start with your original plan, which is the season, which will already be in existence. You will already have a format for next season. That will exist. The issue you might have is you might need to move, just thinking off the top of my head, if what we had to do this year to accommodate Euro 2020 is we had to move the Scottish Cup final. Because the Scottish Cup final this year was supposed to be, what, May the 11th, I think. So it was like a fortnight earlier than normal. And so you might need to do something similar next season, which isn't actually that big a deal, because all you have to do doing that is you just presumably have to move another one of the post-split games to a midweek, not the end of the world. That's easy enough. The winter break could potentially still be accommodated, because you're going to have less...
Well, just to chuck in, the only challenge with doing that post-split games midweek is, as Celtic and Rangers have demonstrated this season, it's not actually beyond the realms of possibility to get to be still playing European competition at that point. So the problem would have been if one of us had got to the Europa League semi-final, the Scottish Cup final would have had to be moved.
Yes, that's true. But that's a semi-final. That's a
no. I'm just meaning they do have to take into consideration the they can't run with no wriggle room. Is my point about why I think the winter break will go, because they do have to live with the possibility that one of us does get a run in European football and you run out of midweek dates.
Well, we still have to last season. With the whole Murrayfield nonsense, they still had the Scottish Cup semis booked in a way where if ourselves and the other lot had... Well, if we'd have got by Copenhagen and the other lot had got by Hearts...
Oh, there would have been a problem for the semis, aye.
It would have caused the same problem. That was still on the cards for this season. They never even just jiggled a couple of the fixtures. So don't bless these people with foresight. They don't have it.
Always remember the first time that they moved the Champions League final to a weekend.
Yep.
Not the chances obviously were exceptionally remote, but they played the Scottish Cup final on the same day as the Champions League final. Showed you how much confidence they had in the Scottish team getting to a Champions League final.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I think UEFA, I might stand corrected in this, but I'm fairly sure UEFA now have it within their broadcasting agreements that you're not allowed to have a game, a major game, the same day as
I think that's right. Yeah,
I think that's now the case. So, I mean, from my point of view, I think what we're going to see is the league's one way or another going to be decided once the leagues get forced into it, once they're done kicking the can down the road. And arguably, it's just going to be a case of then how do we start the season after this one? But then how they decide everything in terms of who goes where is the thing that's kind of getting in my nerves a wee bit, because we've now got this whole thing of you can declare a league null and void, and that's somehow an option. I mean, who on earth thinks you can play 30 games and then just pretend they didn't happen?
So, you know, from that perspective, how are they going to decide? How do you think they should decide who's going to be playing in what competitions, you know, and promotion and relegation throughout the league? I mean, Thistle are a point behind Queen of the South with a game in hand.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you see that we are going to bring all this to an end?
I think you have to be very realistic that at the top of the SPFL there is only ever going to be one winner. There's only ever going to be one club going to get put into the slot of getting into the Champions League, and that's us. And whether we are given the trophy and declared champions officially or not, we are going to be the champions of the league. We are going to go into that Champions League spot. And I think the semantics of that going into the Champions League spot is going to mean that we're seen as champions regardless. So they might as well call us champions. That's my take on it. I don't know. I'm no Michael Beale. I'm not a genius.
You mean you don't think we should just go back to the point where Rangers were last top of the league and then call the league at that point?
I have access to some fairly strong drugs at my work, and don't get me wrong, I'd get sacked if I took most of them. And I have to say, if I saw Michael Beale at my work just before he came out with that, I would be counting what was in the cupboard. That's just... I don't have the words to describe what I think of that. I think this is what we're seeing right now is just posturing, isn't it? Because I think what the clubs, certainly Celtic, you know, that lot down in Govan and Hearts are afraid of, is not being seen to fight the corner. Because what they're all looking at is the revenue for next year in terms of season tickets. And I think if, you know, Celtic have already renewed Celtic season tickets for next year, what Celtic are going to be able to do quite nicely is say, sorry guys, Sharks, we'd love to give you those extra four home games, but, you know, Anyway, here's a nice 9 in a row trophy shaped bowl on top of your season ticket renewal. Give us the money. And by the way, we'll renew French Eddie's contract, and I'm sure everybody will take it and it'll all be lovely. Unfortunately, if you are a supporter of a club who the biggest asset you've gained in the last couple of months isn't title winning momentum or 9 in a row or a trophy, it is a considerable amount of weight that's gone in your star striker's arse, then unfortunately that refund that you see yourself as being owed is going to be a far bigger deal if you don't think that board is fighting your corner.
Yeah. Well, I fully understand why in the Rangers have got to be saying that they're coming up with reasons why we don't just get the title. I fully get that.
After. But I can believe that behind closed doors they're just saying, yeah, okay, fine, just get it over and done with. Let's get the money in and let's go. Because let's face it, they have suppliers for this season.
I mean, you know, the one challenge I can see them having of just calling the season would be the likes of Thistle, who are bottom by a point with a game in hand. That, you know, the game in hand situation. Now, I spoke to someone this week who believed that one way that they might get around that is to do a sort of an average points thing. So not just a simple case of, well, you've averaged, you know, 1.8 points a game to this point, so we're just going to add that up and do that for the rest of the season. But actually try and be a bit more scientific, almost like, for those who are into the cricket, a Duckworth-Lewis version of it, of, right, okay, the games you've got left are against teams in these league positions. You've got your points record against teams in those league positions this season have been X. Trying actually to do it a bit more sophisticated so that, you know, for instance, Rangers have dropped, is it 3 points, I think, to Hearts or something like that. And they've dropped points to Hamilton. So actually, Rangers wouldn't be playing those teams.
Right. Alternatively, let me put it to you this way. Any solution has probably got to be ratified by an EGM, right?
Yeah.
How many teams does it satisfy? Well, not so much satisfy. How many teams are better off if Hearts and Thistle stay up?
Well, if Thistle stay up, if the choice is between Thistle or Queen of the South, Thistle's in the Central Belt and have supporters. Queen of the South are way down in Dumfries. So, you know, because all my relatives are from Cumbria, Workington didn't finish bottom of the English 4th Division in 1974. They got voted out because people were fed up going all the way up to Workington and Cumbria to play games. And that's why, and Wimbledon got promoted to replace Workington because they couldn't be arsed with the travel in the 1960s and 70s of going to Workington, the first chance they got, they voted them out because it was not convenient. So from that perspective, people's preference would be Thistle up.
Really?
Thistle to stay up because there's more money to be generated out of Thistle.
Right, okay.
Queen of the South is a drain on your resources. So from that perspective, the teams in the Championship, Thistle up. From a money perspective, Hearts up over Hamilton. However, Hamilton and St Mirren are not going to vote for anything that doesn't see anything other than Hearts down. Right? So there's two votes for, let's just call, as is, Hearts go down, Celtic are champions. Right?
See, you're wanting behind the scenes and you're trying to engineer, essentially, the league staying as it is. All you have to do is point out to the chairman in the Premiership, Hearts are a very well-funded team, a very powerful team, potentially. Anne Budge, for all that she's a complete and utter muppet, has never made anything but bad decisions that we can see. Can't order seats, has got no idea how to run a football club, and has essentially, you know, got them relegated by being a completely dreadful runner of a team. However, oh, they might cost you money next season by finishing above you, right? That's all you say at the Premiership, Jim. You then go to the guys in the Championship and say, see if you guys vote to put Hearts down. Hearts have got a big travelling support. And there'll be a lot more eyeballs on the Championship next season. Then you go to the League One guys and say, Partick Thistle. Big travelling support there. Wouldn't League One be a wee bit better with Partick Thistle in it? There's actually very good commercial reasons to put Hearts and Partick Thistle down.
Oh, and Hamilton, Ross County, St Mirren, all three of them, if you do something different, it's, you know, a Hearts staying up and them going down.
Mm-hmm.
You call it just now, Motherwell have got European football next season.
Yep. Oh, and let's face it, Motherwell know how to rig a relegation battle, don't they?
And Hibs and Livingston, if you finish the season, St Johnstone have suddenly started performing better. You finish the season and one of them finishes outside the top six, mm-hmm. and replaces St Johnstone. So if you look at the table, for Motherwell, Livingston and Hibs, Celtic, Hamilton, Ross County and St Mirren, for those teams in particular, calling it just now is a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And obviously Celtic as well, calling it just now. I just don't see, I mean, I wrote a piece in the site about it, I just don't see how you can void the season. I just think when you've, particularly when you've already had a trophy won, I just don't see how you can void the season, and voiding the season just causes, it gets back to my point, you void the season, does that mean that UEFA should void the coefficient points that the Scottish teams have won this season in European competition?
That would be disastrous. You void that, all of a sudden, all the sponsors can potentially ask for their money back. You're in a position where, legitimately, fans can ask for their money back.
Yeah.
You know, because... And nobody should get paid any bonuses. You know, Rangers are in massive dispute with their kit supplier as it stands, and with some of their sponsors, who could arguably turn around and say, well, see that season that contract was written for? That didn't happen. You know, it's great. There is no way. You cannot pretend a season of football didn't happen.
And then there'll be a whole lot of disputes between clubs in different leagues and the players for bonuses for finishing in different positions, where the players would turn around and say, but I still want my bonus, and the clubs say, but that season void, so we're not paying you the bonus. There are so many reasons why you just cannot void the season. But they've already given a trophy out this season. 2019-20 is a void season, with the exception of the League Cup. That's not void. Or are you going to take the trophy off Celtic? You're going to say, oh, by the way, I know we won it, you awarded it, and you got all the prize money, but we've now decided that we're not going to do that anymore.
Well, you know, there was the offside.
So, I mean, it just, none of it makes sense.
No, it doesn't. It's just posturing. All that's going on right now is posturing. Until somebody, I think everybody's just waiting for the government to come out and say, right, okay, fine, it's up to us, it's on us, here you go, we'll take responsibility. Because insurance industry seems to be trying to not take responsibility for anything. UEFA's definitely not taking responsibility for anything. You know, it's just an exercise in sort of moving things around a wee bit. You know, the next, I can't remember, podcast that I'd listened to recently, that the, you know, the next PAYE, always Radio Scotland, it was one of the few things that was worth listening to in there. They say there's a PAYE date coming up soon that's going to bankrupt a few clubs, and then of course, as I say, payday is coming up the 30th of April. They're going to have to work something out. You have to finalise the season. You have to finalise the season so that the smaller teams in the league can turn around their sponsors and say, right, that's what we did, give us the money.
And the league itself pays out.
Exactly. You know, this whole thing of, oh, look, the SFA has got £1.5 million in a youth development budget that's going to pay out to people. Really? That's not going to hit the sides, is it?
No. So your expectation is some point in the next 6 weeks, probably, because in sometime in the next 6 weeks, we'll accept that we're not going to be playing football in May.
No, my expectations will be champions by Friday.
Well, I mean, I said on the Buy Them In podcast, I was told this time last week we would be champions by Friday. I did caveat it heavily by saying, you know, taking into consideration that, you know, when Rangers initially went bust, the initial plan was actually for Rangers, the new Rangers, to stay in the top flight. It was only their aggressive sort of antisocial behaviour, for want of a better way of putting it, that they turned everybody against them. So there's always a possibility that changes. And I just think, for one thing, Scottish football knows that they cannot be out on a limb and do different to the rest of European football. And certainly they cannot be the opposite of England, because people would then say, you know, you're being ridiculous. And they know fine well that there's no circumstances that the English are not going to give the Premiership to Liverpool.
This is absolutely correct. There is no way that England is not going to make Liverpool the champions. I think all the leagues are just making the noise of saying, we want to continue. And that's simply so that it is not the leagues and the teams who are the ones who are responsible for this not happening. That's all.
Yeah, it's a bit of pushing because, you know, obviously Real Madrid don't want their fans to think that they've allowed Barcelona to become champions. Rangers don't want their fans to think that they've allowed Celtic to become champions. Manchester United don't want their fans to think that they've allowed Liverpool to become champions. So I think you're right. There needs to be a bigger entity that says, whatever you do, we need the information by X date. And, you know, if UEFA's that, and then if the government then says, look, we're not going to be in this position to free up medics to go and police football, major sporting events, before the end of June. So if the government make it clear that we're not going to get the season finished before the end of June, and UEFA say that they need the entrance for European football by the end of June, then the leagues can say, well, you see, we've just got to make a decision. It's Hobson's choice. This is the best worst case that we can do.
Yeah, and I mean, whether if you remove the 9 in a row and the getting a trophy and put that to one side, if you say, right now, who are the Scottish team who should be put into the Champions League and who are the Scottish team who should be put into the first Europa League qualifying, you know, the first Europa League place, there's no debate. There can be no debate. There should be no debate. Anybody who is arguing beyond Celtic in the Champions League and Rangers being the first Europa League is at it.
Okay, so we've got that settled. So back onto your day job stuff. How's the NHS coping at the moment?
Okay.
NHS in Scotland in particular. I mean, as I said at the beginning, you know, I don't know if I said in the podcast, spoke to you off, for the good of my mental health, because I don't want to be bombarded with dreadful news every day. I'm not watching the national news, which is based in London, where you've got 150% of Scotland's population living in a space the size of Glasgow to Kilmarnock. So it's always going to be much more extreme down there. If you're down in London listening to this, you know, stay safe, and it's. But for up here, how are we coping?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'm going to say before we even get into the detail on this is I think anybody who is spending too much of their time watching the news and getting too carried away with this and is finding themselves too anxious about all this needs to realise that this is something which is going on, but is not something which is directly affecting them. And to a certain extent, you can turn the TV off and not get so worried about it for a period of time. And is watching too much of the news and watching too much of this BBC London-centric coverage, I think, is quite unhealthy for people. what I can say in terms of my direct experience of this is I work in an area of the NHS where we basically run what is predominantly an emergency service. Two-thirds of what we do is classed as emergency work. And it's not emergency work which is going to be directly affected by the whole COVID thing. What we are seeing right now is a lot of our day-to-day work, the stuff that we're doing off waiting lists, so seeing people in clinics or doing operations which can wait months, that's being curtailed because we simply don't have the staff to do it. And the reason for that is people self-isolating. That's the problem we're having right now. So what we're having to do is concentrate on doing what needs to be done. So dealing with operations that need done either as an emergency or stuff that needs doing on a fairly urgent basis. And we're getting that done. But unfortunately, the stuff that people were having to wait on, they're having to wait on a wee bit longer. We, like anybody else, we're a wee bit anxious about the effects of things. We can maybe feel a wee bit more readily because we've got colleagues we know and people we can relate to who are maybe working in far more stressful situations than they're used to, and that's fine. But you know, healthcare professionals are used to just getting on with things, and that's fine, and we are getting on with it. And there are very robust processes and procedures in place for this kind of thing, and they're being swung into action, and it's actually on a certain level quite impressive. So the main thing I'm actually seeing is, as a specialist service that's based in a big hospital in Glasgow that deals with sort of half the country, the problem we are having is we're dealing with a lot of people who are struggling to see their GP about things that we'd maybe expect the GP to deal with. So, you know, someone that's maybe not quite so happy about, you know, I've just had an operation, my wound doesn't look that healthy, can you just eyeball it? There's no real access for them to do that. So we'd maybe have to deal with bringing a few more of them up to Glasgow and reassure them. But, you know, we can cope with that. We'll see how it goes as time goes by, but for the moment, we're everybody's pretty focused on it, and it's more about just making sure we're going to keep the service going.
Okay. We'll get through this. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's it. We have a service which can cope. The main thing is minimising the impact that something like this has on people that need healthcare for other reasons. And a lot of people are very mindful of that. The NHS was basically funded as a public health organisation. I mean, and what public health means is it's all about looking at the health of the nation as a whole. And public health is very much what we're dealing with when we're talking about pandemics. So philosophically, the NHS is in a good position to deal with something like this because it does look at the health of the nation as a whole. It doesn't look at, okay, we can do, you know, tremendously thrilling things that are going to cost an absolute fortune for very little return on an experimental basis. It's not really how it works. NHS is based on being as effective as it possibly can on a basis that it's free at the point of use and is publicly funded. And I think what you are probably going to see in the next few months, if you watch these things, is you'll see the very, very big difference in how the British healthcare system is going to deal with things versus how the American healthcare system is going to deal with things. And I'm very glad I'm on this side.
Because obviously, you know, social media, you get stuff from various people, and I just thought, do you know, I remember when I was 19, my wife, she was my girlfriend at the time, was doing Camp America, and I was working, And I went to see her when she was then, after Camp America, touring around a bit of America for a while. So I went to see her for a couple of weeks. And then I got a Greyhound bus back from Memphis all the way for 2 days straight, all the way to New York to fly home. And I remember having a very passionate defence of the NHS to a young American student who was going to university somewhere.
Yep.
He couldn't get his head around the concept of paying for somebody else to have brain surgery.
Mm-hmm.
For me, effectively paying for somebody else to have brain surgery and not, and being quite happy about that was the way he saw it in terms of, Pete was obviously the other way around. I couldn't comprehend the concept of why you just wouldn't want everybody to have the right to be looked after, no matter how, whether they were pauper or a prince.
Yep.
And it's, I've been reminded of that debate that I had with that guy on that on the Greyhound bus, online on social media, when there's been discussions about the cost of just getting tested in America, and then thinking through about the cost of this vaccine arrives, how much they will, and patently the fact that Trump is changing the language in America from the coronavirus to the China virus. And then he obviously, from what the German papers were writing about, he's desperate for that vaccine, or as he will call it, miracle cure, I've no doubt, to come from America. And then how much he might charge the world for access to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a standard Trumpian move. I mean, he's a businessman, he does deals, and I can see why that would make perfect sense to him, which is hunt down the guys with the cures, let's patent them and we'll sell them. That actually makes perfect sense to him. What I would say to you is that the idea of, you know, free at the point of health, free at the point of access healthcare in the UK makes no more sense to an American. And the idea that you would go to Asda and govern and be able to buy an assault rifle makes sense to you or me. It's just a different way of looking at the world. And we'll see who's right.
I think when a pandemic like this breaks out, I think the concept of everybody having a free to access health service, I just can't comprehend any other system that works when you have a pandemic that you need to keep under control. Giving your whole population free healthcare is the only way to resolve it.
Quite right. And that's why it comes back to, the NHS is a public health body. The whole purpose of the NHS is to improve the health of the nation collectively. That's what it's for. It's not, as I say, it's not about individual treatments. It's not about that. It's to improve the health of the nation collectively. There is no equivalent to that in the US. And that's why the NHS is in a pretty good position to deal with something like this.
Good, because we know the funding of it's not perfect, and we know that there's issues. So to have somebody in it saying, look, it's not, we've got issues, but we're better placed than most to deal with it, it's reassuring.
Look, it's not going to be fun, but I think there's a bit of confidence that it's not going to be as terrible as is being made out, and the reason for that, or what's going to make the difference, is people just slowing this down, people doing what they can to slow this down, and essentially slowing down what gets to the door of the healthcare system. And from what I can see, that seems to be happening, and I'm hopeful that's what's going to continue to happen.
On a flippant note, I have actually been wondering whether the fact that it's been absolutely pissing down in Scotland up until this week, has helped with the lack of social interaction, because we've not been going outside, because we've been miserable with the fact that it's pissing with rain and not going anywhere. Because I was reading about one of the big problems in Italy is they just kept going out and socially interacting, whereas we've been going, fuck's sake, it's raining again, I'm staying in.
I know. Well, that and we tend to be pretty dour people when we talk with our hands under our arms as opposed to waving them everywhere like the Italians. So who knows, there's stereotypes for this everywhere. I don't know, we'll just have to wait and see.
Okay, well, let's hope we get through it. I'd be delighted if we're playing football in July and August, because it means we are through the worst of it. Who knows, but you know, it'd be brilliant if we are. And if we do that as champions, I'm pleased that you're in the same boat as me. We might know this week. And then we will definitely get you on, because it's really important to talk about the dementia and football thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, I mean, you can either do that or, you know, just make sure you go and buy the minute and defend yourself tomorrow, because I'm really looking forward to hearing that.
Well, because I said the league would be over. I caveated it. I don't know. I don't know. Lawrence List hears what he wants to hear, I think.
Have you not been listening to them? They've been on every night this week, and there's going to have to be a drum roll the next time you're on that one, son.
Oh, well, you know, you never know. Maybe, you know, maybe I could be just 24 hours out.
See? Well, I mean, did you say which Friday?
No, I didn't say which Friday, exactly.
Yeah, that's you. That's your get out.
All right, well, with that...
You owe me a wee sort of Celtic Underground super dry with my name embroidered on it for that.
Yes, I'll send you one over Twitter. With that, Pablo, I will say thanks very much.
No worries, Harry. Thanks very much. See you later, everybody. Remember, wash your hands.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast. There will be more along soon. If you've listened to the By the Wind podcast, you'll know that I said Celtic would be champions by Friday. I also said that things were subject to change, so we'll get there. As you heard in the podcast, football authorities just need to get the proper guidance. We're not playing again this season. Anyway, enough of me. As you heard Pablo say there, don't watch too much of the news. We know things are going to be challenging. Don't let it get you down. If you are self-isolating, take care. We've got more Celtic games to see between us. So take care, everybody. Look after yourself. Do the social distancing. Wash your hands. And we'll get through this. This is me, Harry Brady. That was him, at Pablo567, if you want to follow on Twitter, saying goodnight and God bless. And take care. Good night. You can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.